Good evening, everyone. Let's begin by cultivating our motivation tonight. Let's remember that we have a precious opportunity to study and practice the Dharma. Because we have a precious human life, we're able to understand and practice the Buddha's teachings. And as we practice, we transform ourselves. We develop our good qualities. We become kinder to others and to ourselves. And as we do this, we progress upon the path. And we deepen our trust in the Buddha's teachings. And we begin to see the potential we have to free ourselves from cyclic existence. And we cultivate the mind of love and compassion that cherishes others and seeks Buddhahood so that we can lead them on the path. And so let's cultivate this far-reaching aspiration for full enlightenment and for the benefit of all sentient beings. Jigme, and I'm going to be reviewing the teachings that Venerable Children has been giving on the text, The Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun. And tonight we're going to talk about karma. And just for a little review, we've gone over some of the preliminary practices that the book presents. And these practices are preliminary to generating bodhicitta and doing the other mind training practices. And so before we can learn and practice the actual techniques of cultivating bodhicitta, we need to study and contemplate these preliminary practices. And so there's four of them in this context. And do we remember what they are? Yes, precious human life. Impermanence, yes.
Karma.
Yeah. And cyclic existence. Yes. Yeah, good. So although these are called preliminary practices, they're actually quite complex. They're not simple to do. They take a lot of concentration and understanding. You have to have the right motivation, taking refuge in the three jewels so that it becomes a Buddhist practice. So we need to spend some time on these. So just because they're preliminary, they're not simple at all. And if we practice these well, then we really build a very nice foundation for the practices that follow. So the mind training teachings are mostly concerned with developing the awakening mind, bodhicitta. And they're concerned with really transforming our attitudes with other beings. And last week, Frederick gave a nice review of the practice of contemplating death and impermanence. And in that teaching, we were reminded of the value of our human life and that it doesn't last long. And so then that helps us to remember to really use our life the best possible way. So meditating on death and impermanence really wakes us up to practicing Dharma. Now, if we put these preliminaries in the context of the Lam Rim teachings, the first three, precious human life, death and impermanence, and karma, they're in the initial level practitioner. And in this initial level, we see the preciousness and rarity of human life. We see impermanence. And we see that our lives are mortal. and that it's possible to be reborn in an unfortunate rebirth. And if we look around, we can really observe this. It may be kind of difficult to think about the lower realms, the hell realms. I don't, what does that mean? Not so sure, maybe. But if we just look around at the animals and the insects, for example, we spend a lot of time in the meditation hall, and especially when we do our 3-month retreat, and spending time in there, I've observed the insects, and you can learn a lot about watching them, actually. There's a lot of house flies and spiders in the meditation hall. And especially the house flies, they have a pretty short life, and so you can actually observe their aging, sickness, and death in the span of maybe a day. And what I've noticed when I watch these beings go through this process, each one of them reacts to their circumstance differently. Some of them, as they're starting to age, and the first thing that seems to happen is they're not able to fly. So some of them keep trying as hard as they can to fly, and great effort, it looks like. And they'll go a little distance and then crash and fall and usually land on their back. And then they spend all the rest of their energy trying to get themselves right side up again. And oftentimes they die on their back. Then there's another group that is more tentative about trying to fly again. So they take these little hops. And they don't really go upside down, but they spend all their energy trying to fly again, these little hops. And then the third group that I've noticed are the ones that seem to know they can't fly anymore, and they don't try, and they just walk around until they die. So what that tells me is that these sentient beings are very individual. They come with karma. They have their habits and patterns, just like we do. And then if you think about it for a minute, out of all the places in the world they end up living and dying, it's in a meditation hall. And the meditation hall has all the Buddhist teachings, all the commentaries, holy objects, people practicing, and they cannot access any of that. There's not one thing they can get from that, and it's all right there. But yet, out of all the places that they could end up living, it's not a garbage can. It's the meditation hall. So that says that somewhere in some lifetime, they've met the Dharma at some point, because they're very close to it. So that really keeps reminding me that, you know, the future rebirths are based on the causes that we're creating today. And so it's very important to stay very aware of that, I think. And it's taught to us continually if we just look. So being born in an unfortunate realm is created by our actions. We're the ones who create the causes. Nobody else can cause us to have another rebirth. And so that's why these thought trainings are so important, because they teach us how to take care of our mind. So after we meditate on our precious human life, death and impermanence, possibility of being born in the lower realm, then the goal naturally arises. We don't want to be born in an unfortunate rebirth at all. And so this circumstance and this thinking of this this way, then, that's the aspiration of somebody in the initial scope of practice. And so then, how do we actualize that aspiration? Well, by taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And so we really put our trust in and guidance to the three jewels. And as we do that, then we start developing faith. And this faith that we start developing isn't blind faith. It's the kind of faith that is built upon reading and studying, meditating, receiving teachings, and really trying it out and seeing that it actually works. And that's what really starts developing some deep faith. And then as we develop this deep faith, it brings a real steadiness into our practice. It feels secure then. It feels something that we can rely upon. Mm-hmm. And then we're not plagued then by doubts, and we're not, you know, seeking, going after, you know, this path, that path. We really stay in the Dharma because this faith is quite quite steady for us. It keeps the mind quite steady. So the first instruction the Buddha gives to us is to observe karma and its effects. A very important teaching, karma. The more I've studied it, the more I'm really realizing. So again, it points to, if you study and reflect on these things, you start going deeper with it and understand how important. So we'll start again in the book here where we left off. And that's on page 33 for those that have the book. And it says, contemplating in this way, how ultimately death is certain, its time is uncertain, and at the time nothing is of any help except the doctrine, resolve to practice it now. Within the holy doctrine, meditation on the awakening mind is the primary practice. Having ascertained this, everything will become a factor of the training in the awakening mind. So this, again, this section reminds us of the fleeting nature of our life, and that the reliable path is the Dharma, and that's what most helps us in this life and actually also at our death. And it further teaches that the primary, most important practice is meditation on this awakening mind, on bodhicitta. But we can't just grab that and now we have it. It doesn't work that way. There are many causes that we have to generate first before we can create the cause of bodhicitta. And so we can see the value of it, but in order to generate it, we have to start at the beginning of the path. And so we start on this meditation on karma. And meditating on karma is really important because if you truly believe it exists and that it brings effects, then that starts to influence how we live. Yeah. How we live our lives. And often when I think back, like one time somebody broke into my car, broke the window, and, you know, went into the glove box and, you know, took some things. And when that happens, you know, we think, oh, that's my karma ripening. But how many times in our life do we think about the result before we do the action? How many times do we think about what the result will be before we do an action? I think not so often. So if we don't familiarize and meditate on karma, then when it comes to making decisions, we end up using the eight worldly concerns as our standard. And so this keeps us locked in samsara, all wrapped up into how we can get money and possessions, avoid losing them, how to get praise and avoid blame, good reputation, avoid a bad one, have sense pleasure and avoid painful experiences. And so if we're practicing these eight worldly concerns, we're generating a lot of negative karma. There's no way you can't. So karma is a Sanskrit word. It means action. And again, trust in karma is developed from understanding how it works, the kinds of results that arise from what kinds of actions. And if we fail to observe the principles of karma, all roads to liberation are closed. So it's pretty important. So we're doing physical and mental and verbal actions all the time. And these actions are done with intention. And so intention is a mental factor that creates our mind, that directs our mind to the object and helps us create a motivation to do something. So it's the actual principle of activity. And in some of the Buddhist tenets, they say that intention is karma. Some of them believe that. So from intention comes action of body or speech or mind. And much of the time we're not aware of our intentions. We kind of go on automatic and don't even think there's intentions in the mind often. But if we slow down, especially if we meditate, we can start watching the mind, and we can see that there are intentions that arise in the mind going on all the time. So if we're angry, that colors the mental factor of intention. And we begin to use harsh speech, get defensive, blame others. If our mind is influenced by a mind of tolerance, then the mental factor of intention has a clearer mind. We have the intention to be present, not judgmental, accepting. So when we start becoming mindful of our actions, it's easiest to start working with the gross physical level first, and then next to our speech, and then the hardest one is with the mind. And so gross level, a good example would be, so if I'm at home and I have the thought, oh, I might have left the stove on under the tea kettle. So then the intention would be to get up and go look. But what's coloring that is my fear or anxiety that the kettle is on and it's burned. So this fear, which isn't based in reality at all, is influencing my intention, and then physically how I get up and go look is with a lot of anxiety, very fast, moving through space quickly. And it's really based on something that isn't necessarily happening. And so lots of times if you can recognize the feeling in the body when the intention has arisen and there's an affliction with it, or, you know, anxiety, then you can start slowing that down a little bit. And instead of running into the kitchen, walking in there and see what the reality actually is. Now, maybe that doesn't seem like a big thing, but what that does to the body is pretty significant. The body reacts to that fear. That body reacts to that anxiety. There's adrenaline going on. And if we do that a lot of times in the day, we really are starting to wear out ourselves. It's using a lot more energy than we need to. So there's a lot of different ways that we can work with intention and with what's coloring the intention. So if I get irritated at somebody, if I don't recognize that internally, then oftentimes harsh speech comes out. But if I can get a little space between what arises and the behavior, then I can start modulating, start transforming that, and doing less harmful actions then. And now, of course, the hardest one is working with the mind. To start with the physical reactions and actions and behaviors, and then the verbal ones are first to start with. so it's kind of like, it feels like to me, like when I can do that, it's like interrupting a knee-jerk reaction and getting some space and considering what I'm going to do and what's moving me to do it, what's motivating me. So a lot of us were taught to not do bad things to others because it hurts them. So when we act in a negative behavior, often we feel guilty. And sometimes when we feel that guilt, we feel like that kind of purifies the action, but it doesn't. And oftentimes also, if we do something that hurts someone else, we feel very bad about ourselves, and we feel like we're bad people. And it's really important to separate out the behavior from the person. If we think we're really bad, then it's really hard to work with the content and change things. We're just kind of stuck in that. So to really separate out, if you do a negative action, that doesn't mean you're a bad person. We harm ourselves when we harm others. So if I put negative energy out, it's going to come back to me. There's no way it can't. It leaves a seed in my mind. And so as we become more and more aware of our actions through meditation and we behave in a negative manner, then we start getting the information about that. So if I get irritated in somebody and say something harsh back to them, after I do that, I have an uneasy feeling in my body. I don't feel calm at all. I don't feel happy. I feel distress. Now, if I respond to that distress by justifying why I've been speaking the way I have, then that just takes you down a whole nother path. But at the end of that, still don't feel good. It doesn't help. So when there's an easy feeling to look inward and see and start asking the questions, why? Why do I feel uneasy? And then I can come to, well, it's because I said something that wasn't very kind, and that's affecting me. And so then I can start working with that. If I don't bring it back to me, then I'm projecting it out to the other person, what they've done, and create this whole story about what it is. But I don't feel better when I do that. So learning to be honest with ourselves and to admit to ourselves how we've behaved, then that evolves into the practice of purifying and confession, which is very powerful. Because we can't change a pattern or a habit until we make ourselves aware of it. We have to be very present with it. Otherwise, we just keep creating the story of it's the other person, and if they just did this instead of that, then this wouldn't happen. So the only way we can start really actually transforming and working is when we turn around and look at what we're doing, what our behavior is. And so when we do these purification practices, then that clears it up and we can let it go. So next we're going to talk a little bit about the qualities of karma. So the actions and their consequences. So again, and back to the text. It says, after death we do not cease to exist, but have to take rebirth. Our place of birth will either be happy or miserable according to our actions rather than our free will. Therefore, it is reasonable to try and cultivate good actions properly and avoid bad ones. Now, when Venerable taught this, she had some difficulty with the translation of this particular stanza. And she thought that it would be clearer, more accurate, actually, if it read, after death, we do not cease to exist, but have to take rebirth. Our place of birth will either be happy or miserable according to our actions rather than our choice. So instead of using free will, she said to use choice, and that would be clearer. So this, again, passage is reminding us that we can't choose how and where we're going to be reborn. Rather, the actions that we're doing right now are what's going to determine where we end up. And at the time of that we're dying, depending on what kind of thoughts in our mind, depending on the karma that's ripening at the time, our mind stream then will become attracted to a different rebirth. And again, that reminds me of the houseflies in the meditation hall. Yeah. It's very easy to see how I feel very connected to the Dharma. But if I don't watch my body, speech, and mind, perhaps next life, I'm in a meditation hall. Yeah. So oftentimes, too, though, when karma is taught, especially when you first hear it, at least to me, it sounded quite simplistic. It was really linear. Kill an animal, reborn next life as that animal. And it's not simple like that at all. There are many, many, many causes and conditions that come together for something to arise. And it said, I think it was Geshe Sopa, actually, he said, it is the details of the relation, it is said that the details of the relationship between karma and its results is extremely profound and subtle. They are much more difficult to understand fully than emptiness. So that puts it in perspective. Emptiness is very difficult, and so this is more difficult than that. So the good news is that karma can be changed by purifying harmful actions and creating good actions, and dedicating and making prayers and aspirations. So there's many conditions in this lifetime that can affect how karma ripens. And so when someone dies, we make special prayers and dedications for them every 7 days. Because if they haven't found a rebirth yet and they go through another mini-death, then while we're making those prayers and aspirations, that can actually affect how they're reborn, what form they take. And so that's very soothing to the mind also when we experience the death of somebody that we care for. So there's four chief characteristics of karma. The first one is the certainty of actions and their results. The second is the multiplying nature of actions. The third is not having to face the consequences of actions you have not done. And the fourth is, once committed, actions do not fade away. And so if we study these and keep them in mind, they are going to help us when we make our decisions moment by moment. And so we'll go through these characteristics a bit here. So the first one says, it's the certainty of actions and their results. All instances of happiness or suffering, whether coarse or subtle, are the results of specific wholesome and unwholesome actions. And then the Precious Garland says, all sufferings are the result of unwholesome actions, so likewise are all bad rebirths. The pleasure enjoyed throughout our lives and all happy rebirths are the result of virtue. So the Buddha looked at sentient beings and saw when sentient beings had the results of happiness, then he looked at what those causes were and called them constructive actions. And when he saw sentient beings that were miserable, then the karmic causes were called destructive actions. And so these constructive and destructive actions aren't some commandment that he made up, not some law he set down. It's purely just because of the way dependent arising works in our own minds, the way causes produce effects in our own minds. And so then he described these. The second characteristic of karma is the multiplying nature of actions. So when we do an action, it leaves seeds in our mind stream, and these seeds intensify in strength. And the text says, a small, wholesome, or unwholesome cause can give rise to a much greater happy or miserable result. The special verses collected by topic says, performing even the smallest misdeed will lead to great fear and trouble in future lives, like poison that has entered the body. Creating even a small meritorious act will bring forth great joy in future lives and fulfill the great purpose, like grain ripening into a bumper crop. And so again, if we think about small actions that we can do every day, those are creating virtue. And so the simple things like setting up our water bowls, bowing in front of the Buddha, making our prostrations, all of these activities, offering to the altar, all of these activities are creating virtue. So when the mind starts thinking, at least mine does, it's like, oh, it's kind of a simple thing. You know, I'm busy, gotta go. To try not to let your mind do that one. Because every time that we do these actions, even small, we don't know how big the result is going to be. It could be huge. We don't know. And especially if we do these actions thinking about bodhicitta while dedicating for the benefit of sentient beings and meditating on emptiness, makes it triply then strong. And again, if we're involved in something that, again, feels a little uneasy and we start minimizing it, oh, it's not such a big deal, a little white lie, no problem. We don't know what the result of that's going to be. It could be huge. And we don't know when. So to really kind of pay attention and be aware of and watch for the justifying mind and the minimizing mind, I try to do that, to watch when I start to minimize something. I try to think, what's my intention here? What's going on? Why am I doing that? Especially when it has to do with dharma. Very important. And that minimizing negative actions, that's always a self-centered attitude, always, at least in my mind. So then the text goes on to say, just as the shadow of the bird accompanies it in the sky, so beings follow after wholesome and unwholesome actions. And again, so we follow our karma. So if I've created a lot of positive actions in this life, then that's what's going to follow in next life. Yeah. So it's kind of common sense, actually. But the important thing to remember with this one is that either way, the result can be huge compared to what the action was. The result can be huge. And we don't have the knowing of that. We just don't know. The text goes on to say, just as the traveler with few provisions will suffer on the road, so sentient beings who do not do good will come to a bad end. Just as the traveler with plentiful provisions will have an enjoyable journey, so sentient beings who have done good will go to a happy rebirth. And we should not do even the smallest wrong, thinking it will do no harm, for the accumulation of drops of water will gradually fill a large vessel. And don't think little wrongs I've done will make no difference later, for just as a single water drop gradually fills a large vessel, so ordinary beings become filled with wrongs collected little by little. And don't think little virtues I've done will make no difference later, for just as single water drops gradually fill a large vessel, so the steadfast are filled with virtue, collected little by little. So all of those are really good pictures to keep in the mind about how we accumulate and how things can multiply. I think, too, what came up for me on this when I was studying this, the multiplying one especially, that just brings home how so important it is to do a purification practice every day. Because our present store of negativities, whatever those are, don't know, but whatever they are, they're going to continue to increase. And it's like borrowing a huge sum of money. You know, the interest just keeps compounding. And if the purification practice is undertaken properly, using the four opponent powers, then there's no reason why we can't purify these negativities. The Buddha taught that there are actions that we do that create negative karma. He taught that there are techniques to use that purify the negative karma. And it's not helpful at all to doubt the Buddha. Why would we believe some of the things he teaches and not others? That doesn't make sense. And then personally speaking, doing a three-month Vajrasattva retreat, it changes you. It transforms you. So experientially, I know this to be the case. So they always have the nature of being purified if we use these methods. So the third characteristic of karma, we only face consequences of actions we have done. So if you have not accumulated an action, whether it would give rise to pleasure or pain, you will not experience its consequence. Those who enjoy the fruits of the infinite merits accumulated by the teacher do not have to collect all their causes, but they must at least do their part. So this stanza, so the first part, just reminds us that if we don't create the causes for happiness, that we're not going to experience it. But the next sentence explains that we're able to benefit from the Buddha's teachings because he accumulated that merit that enabled him to become a Buddha. But we must have done something on our part to be able to hear the teachings, because that doesn't happen without cause. Yeah. So that's why when we do the seven-lin prayer and we ask for the will of Dharma to be turned, that creates the cause to receive teachings. And then every time we go to a teaching, that creates the cause for more teachings. So it's very important to kind of remember those lines. And again, when you're going to minimize or talk yourself out of going to a teaching, think of this one and get yourself there. The fourth point about karma, once committed, actions do not fade away. The especially exalted praise says, "The Brahmins say that virtues and misdeeds can be given away and transferred, but you teach that actions done do not fade away, and actions not done have no consequences." So we can't transfer our karma to someone else. Our karma is our karma. The King of Meditative Stabilization Sutra also says, "It is impossible not to encounter the results of your deeds, but you won't feel the results of those done by others." And then the Transmission of Discipline says, even after hundreds of eons, actions are not exhausted. If they meet with the assembled conditions, then embodied beings will meet their results. So even if we've done something eons ago, and who knows, don't know, it doesn't get lost. So as soon as we meet with the cooperative conditions in this lifetime, even a seed created so long ago, it can ripen, and then we experience the results. And so again, Geshe Sopa says, once karma is created, it is never lost. Until it yields its results, or is purified by applying the antidote. So it's in there, so purifying is the key here. The text goes on to say, so remembering the certainty and multiplying nature of karma, that an action not done will yield no result, and that once done, an action will not fade away, will obstruct all that gives rise to actions. So if we study and bring these four characteristics to mind, then there's no way that you want to engage in any non-virtuous action. But we have to study these and keep these in mind. We have to keep them close to us. They need to be on the surface of our mind. And again, it says that you must earnestly engage in wholesome, virtuous actions, and since training in the precious awakening mind is considered to be the principal and supreme virtue, all of them should be part of that training. And so here, if we do actions motivated by bodhicitta, then that increases and enhances the virtue. And then that brings other good results. So it really kind of builds upon itself that way. And so this concluded what the book had to say about karma in this section. Venerable Chidren, because she believes this is such an important topic, she went on to teach some more. And so by contemplating the four principles of karma, then the question naturally arises, how do we put this knowledge into practice? So we need to examine which actions need to be avoided and which need to be cultivated. And so that's when we get into looking at the 10 non-virtues and the 10 virtues and the four factors necessary for a complete karma. So to have a complete karma, to have a complete action, that is going to be strong enough to bring a future rebirth, you have to have four factors. And the first is the object, the second is the intention, the third is the action, and the fourth is the completion of the action. So when you think about your mind, we have limitless thoughts, and out of these thoughts, countless actions all the time. And so the Buddha condensed all of these actions into these 10 general categories. So it's pretty brilliant, actually. And he taught us that these 10 virtues need to be cultivated and the 10 non-virtues need to be abandoned. And so once we know these, then we know what to practice. And then Venerable talked a lot about the language that we use when we talk about 10 non-virtues. And she said that they're not 10 negative actions, as we sometimes call them. They're all paths of action, but they are not all actions. And they're called paths of actions because they're conduits leading to future lives. So it becomes a path of action when we have all four of the parts of the action complete. And if the karma is strong enough, then it results in a future rebirth. So the 7 of body and speech are karma because they are the intention to commit an action. But the 3 mental ones, they're actually afflictions. And so what are the 3 physical ones? Yeah, stealing, killing, unwise sexual behavior, the 4 verbals, divisive speech, harsh words, idle talk, yeah. And then the 3 mental ones, coveting, malicious, wrong views, yeah. So these 3 mental karmas, the coveting, malicious, and wrong views, are only karmic paths. They are karmic paths because they are the cause or source from which an intention arises. So again, we have this intention again that's so important. So the mental factor of intention, that's one mental factor. Coveting is a form of greed or attachment. Maliciousness, a form of anger or hatred. Distorted views, a form of confusion. So if we use the example of greed, the mind that's full of greed has a mental factor of intention. The mental factor of intention is the karma. The mental factor of greed is what makes it non-virtuous. So those two together is what then colors this. So these are actually afflictions. But they're in the mind stream with an intention. So the intention becomes the karma. When we act physically or verbally, though, these are actions. the body and speech are the instruments that the mind is using to express. So if we look at these four factors that create a complete karma, we can make the example of stealing. So the first factor is the object. So it would be the object that we intend to steal. And the second factor, intention, this has three parts. The first is discrimination, which means that we must identify the object properly. So if you intend to steal one object and you steal another, then it's not a complete action. It's not a complete karma. The second one is that there has to be a mental affliction present. Without the mental affliction, it's not going to color the intention to become something negative. The third part is that we have to be motivated to do the action. We must have the wish to do it. And so that comes up when you do something accidentally, like, you know, if you were driving in the car and hit a pedestrian. It wouldn't be a complete karma because, you know, it wasn't your intention. That wasn't what you were planning to do. So the third factor is doing the actual action then, and the fourth is the completion of the action. So if we go through these four factors with examples in our lives, that's how we start to really understand karma. That's when it starts coming into our heart then. It becomes part of us. It's not just sitting in our brain twirling around a bit, that we have to actually make these examples over and over again so that we can see what our behaviors are bringing, what kind of results. And then the 10 virtuous paths of action are the abstention of the 10 negative ones. So being in a situation where you could kill and you choose not to. So that's always a good one when the mosquito is biting the arm and you go, nope, nope, yeah. And then the really, really lovely part of this that I like is that if we've taken precepts and to not do certain actions and we're holding them, we're not doing the action, every moment that we're not doing the action, we're accumulating merit, virtue. That's just lovely. That's like the best bank account, yeah? It's very good. Again, I think that it's really important that we acknowledge our virtuous activities. I know for me, in my mind, I can give you the list of all the non-virtues I've done, and I know them inside out, you know. I can give you a lot of information. But when I sit down and start thinking of the virtuous ones, that's harder to do. And it's really, I think it's really important to do. When I don't, I start getting down on myself. The path starts getting quite heavy. It feels too hard to do, almost. So I think it really is very important, very helpful to balance out and to train ourselves to acknowledge our virtuous efforts. If you don't acknowledge something, it's not in there. And so then our view of ourself is quite skewed, I think. I don't think it's a complete view then of who we are. So I think it's very important. I think if we don't, we kind of get stuck in that self-centered, I'm not good enough one. At least I do. If I don't really look to keep a whole view of myself. Because there is no person that only does non-virtuous actions. No person. That's impossible. Impossible. I mean, we have stories all the time of people that did horrendous things and maybe end up in prison. And you see them in there and they are lovingly taking care of a bug in their cell, or if they could have a plant or something, keeping it alive, or their connection with their mother or their family or something that they're very kind to. So the next section is transforming neutral actions into virtuous actions. And this is also a lovely one. So we do a lot of actions that are neutral. They're not non-virtuous or virtuous. A lot of the mundane things we do in life, the sweeping the floor, the cleaning the house, getting the groceries, all of those things. And the thought training practices teach us how we can start transforming these neutral activities into virtuous ones. And this is just really a very powerful, lovely practice. Venerable has been teaching on this, actually, when she's been teaching on the 41 prayers of bodhisattvas, when she's here at the Bodhisattva Breakfast Corner. And that teaching, that prayer, is teaching on how to transform neutral actions into virtuous ones. So I included some of these so you can kind of get the flavor of this. At least for my mind, this is not how my mind thinks. So this is something that you have to train yourself to do, like all the mind trainings. That's why they call them trainings. So the first one is, may all beings awaken from the sleep of ignorance when waking up. Next, may all beings wear the robes of integrity and consideration for others when putting on clothes. May all beings come to drink the nectar of wisdom when holding a cup. May all beings attain the food of meditative concentration when eating. Or may I open the door of liberation for all beings when opening a door. Now, these are very beautiful. This isn't really in the language that I think in, though. So this reminds me of kind of a positive affirmation language. If you don't internalize it and make it yours, it doesn't fly. You can't really access it. But you get the idea of this. So it's kind of, again, it's back to that intention. Every time I'm going to go in and clean the dishes, just as a gift to myself, how can I think about turning this activity into something that becomes virtuous? Now, if I'm really serious about becoming a Buddha, I need a lot of virtue, I need a lot of merit accumulated. So here's a way to do that. So everything that we can do really can start becoming part of the path then. And that's just brilliant, isn't it? It's just lovely. But we have to train ourselves to use this, and so that it becomes familiar. So that it isn't something that's really hard to do, that it starts getting more and more familiar. And then when you think about it, like if I'm going in and doing the dishes, the level I'm at, it's, I'm all about me usually. And so I'm thinking, I'm cleaning the defilements of my mind. So that's what I can do right now. I haven't brought in others yet. That's okay. But at least I'm bringing it in. And as I continue to bring this in, soon I'm going to start then bringing in others. That's just what happens. Yeah. So, wherever you can start with this. And then when you're doing it, it's really hard to be in a foul mood when you're using your mind this way. The mind is happy. The mind is happy. So it's the mind that transforms these actions into something virtuous. Oh, I'm almost done. Gosh. So let's see. I'll just kind of wrap up here. We almost got through it all. So when we do practices in front of Buddha statues, when we're making offerings, prostrations, saying mantra, all these things, when we get familiar with these, at least if you have a mind like mine, I can be reciting or going through the visualizations, these complex things in my mind, and I have this other part of my mind thinking about, the list of the things I have to do. So as we become more and more familiar Every day we have to work more and more with intention. The mind will follow the intention. And if you don't do that, because we're in front of holy things, we're getting some virtue, a little bit of merit, but not much. But if we are present with it, then that's when it really becomes very rich, and it starts transforming. So every day to really set your intention, and then when you get distracted, bring yourself back. If you continue to get distracted, then start working with the affliction that's distracting you. So, you know, anger, jealousy, whatever it is, irritation, whatever it is, start working with that. Start getting to know what that is so that you can start moving it, so that it doesn't plague your mind, so that you can start moving it. Okay, I think I'll stop there.
Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and non-violent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West.